Thus, humans only have the right to use God's creation for their real needs, plus the duty not to wantonly destroy created beings, wanton destruction of which would be an unjustified overextension of that original right. Now, when that human right over non-human nature is overextended, it thereby violates God's creator right, which means that all other creatures having intellect and will, who seem to be humankind alone, are duty-bound to treat the rest of God's creation with respect. Along these lines, then, I don't see how, from a traditional Jewish perspective, one can speak of either animal rights or environmental rights, inasmuch as neither animals nor any other creatures seem to have intellect and will, nor are they descended from creatures who have intellect and will. Intellect and will are certainly necessary attributes of anyone who can be cogently called a rights holder and duty bound. In fact, a more persuasive case can be made for the protection of animals and the environment from wanton destruction by humans when God's creator right to have God's creation respected is emphasized instead of the irrational presumption that these creatures are rights holders themselves. In fact, how can one presume they are rights holders when no one could cogently propose that these non-human creatures can act dutifully? Nevertheless, in our respect and care of non-human creatures, they and not God are the first objects of our respect and care. Plus, our sympathy with them is usually the immediate source of that respect and concern. This comes out especially in notions of Tzar Bale Chaim, the prohibition of causing pain to sentient creatures. We only learn who is the indirect object of that respect and concern and who is their original source from revelation about God as the creator and nurturer of all creation. Now, getting back to human rights, it would seem that humans in their natural social state do not experience the claim upon themselves to do justice to becoming directly from God. Instead, they experience that claim to becoming directly from the cries of their fellow humans who are the victims of injustice. Courts of law are essentially established to systematically respond to these cries in an appropriate fashion. Therefore, in this first natural commandment, that is the commandment of dinim, to practice justice, humans in their natural social state do not experience the commandment as a direct divine right or a claim made upon themselves. Instead, at this level, God is the one who ultimately enables or empowers the victims of injustice to make their claims upon their fellow humans because they are God's image. And God ultimately authorizes those capable of responding to these claims to do so because, as God's image, their working or actualizing justice in the world is ultimately an imitation of God, who is the judge of the whole world, who does justice. HaShofet kol haaretz yaseh mishpat. Nevertheless, both the original enabling of the victims of injustice to intelligently seek justice and the ultimate authorization of those who adjudicate on their behalf, neither are claims God makes for God's self. In other words, it's not God saying, do it because I need the justice, do it because they need the justice. So therefore, the notion of the Selamohim is both the subject and the object of the doing of justice. Accordingly, they are not claims in the usual human sense of claims as rights which claimants exercise for themselves. Instead, they are divine entitlements that enable or empower victims of injustice to exercise their right to receive justice and that authorize legal authorities to exercise their duty to effect as much justice in the world as they can. Those divine entitlements are discovered retrospectively, that is, after effecting justice as a response to the experience of injustice. Humans imagine, outside of revelation, that is, the infallible source of that justice as one who stands above fallible human will. It is within the covenanted community that God exercises God's divine rights for God's self, stemming from God's desire, as expressed in numerous biblical texts, for an ongoing intimate relationship with God's elect people, a point made many times. That relationship is lived and celebrated when the people keep the commandments of the Torah, especially those commandments whose direct object is God's self. And that is seen in the beginning of the Decalogue, I am the Lord your God who is taking you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods in my presence. The recognition of God as liberator from slavery is not so much a claim on the people's gratitude as it is a divine assertion that just as God has graciously benefited the people by taking them out of Egypt, so God will continue to graciously benefit the people by giving them commandments that will enable them to survive in the wilderness and to flourish in the promised land where the covenantal life with God can be best lived. That covenantal life requires the total and ongoing commitment of the people to the one God with whom they are now involved in an unconditional and everlasting relationship. That relationship must not be diluted in any way by including in it any other objects of worship or devotion, hence the subsequent prohibition of idolatry of any kind. Only the exclusivity of the covenantal relationship is determined. Once the exclusivity of the covenantal relationship is determined, the people can accept in good faith the other commandments that primarily benefit them in this relationship and that give content to this covenantal relationship. So despite all the universal implications of these commandments in the Decalogue, they are still only addressed to Israel. They are God's claim upon his covenanted people alone. So it could be said that from the Bible's perspective, idolatry is the worship of other gods, who could be seen as gods of the others, Elohim Acherim, is only prescribed to Israel. For if idolatry is comparable to adultery, then just as a woman, to whom Israel is sometimes compared by the prophets and the rabbis, cannot be an adulteress unless she is already a party to a marital covenant, so Gentiles who are not covenanted with the one God cannot be guilty of idolatrous unfaithfulness, since there is no covenant with him to which they could be unfaithful. Just as in the case of a woman, only her spouse has a right to her faithfulness, and which is a right he may not waive. However, Maimonides, building on the rabbinic teaching that idolatry is prescribed to all human beings everywhere, assumes that the prohibition of idolatry is the obverse of the positive commandment. Indeed, for him, the most primary positive commandment is to affirm the being of God, which can be rationally demonstrated. And this is what later thinkers have called natural theology. And this affirmation of the being of God is called for by the universal apprehension of the absolute and necessary being of God, hence a truth that itself commands, as it were, its own positive affirmation by everyone in the world intelligent enough to do so, and which entails the proscription, the prohibition of all idolatry that necessarily contradicts it. Nevertheless, I would think modern advocates of human rights, especially the right of religious liberty, might be wary of Maimonides' approach for political reasons, let alone its metaphysical problems. For if the affirmation of God's being is a metaphysical necessity, doesn't that suggest that it should be a political necessity too? Doesn't that at least suggest that the affirmation of God's existence, which inevitably takes on the character of the tradition of the person so promoting it, will soon turn into the type of religious coercion which at times has been practiced by Christians and Muslims especially? As such, there might be very good political reasons for adopting the more tolerant view of the absence of universal divine rights, whether negative or positive. Now, in the area of interhuman relations, to see how asserting a priority in the correlation of rights and duties does make a difference in the way the intentions of the commandments, all of which involve this correlation, are understood, let us turn to the most famous biblical commandment, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, Ya'atzerecha kamocha. It is also the foundation of all Jewish moral law. And contrary to a prevalent misconception, the commandment of neighbor love does not command us to feel good about our neighbor. And Kant said, for example, how can you possibly command people to feel? The commandment of neighbor love does not command us to feel good about our neighbor, though it is a good or virtuous thing to do, amidah tova in Hebrew, to cultivate feelings of benevolence in order to be better able to intend the beneficence our neighbor deserves from me. In the Jewish tradition, the commandment prescribes specific acts of beneficence, such as comforting one's neighbor when he or she is mourning the loss of a close relative. Nevertheless, taking neighbor love to be my neighbor's right to be loved by me can only claim that I act lovingly with him or her in a personally beneficial way. Feelings cannot be formally claimed. They can only be informally elicited by attraction. Now, about the great commandment, we might ask, are we commanded to love our neighbor since God has so designated our neighbor to be the object of our love? Or are we commanded to love our neighbor because our neighbor is essentially lovable? Let me repeat that. It's like the Euthyphro problem. Are we commanded to love our neighbor since God has so designated our neighbor to be the object of our love? or are we commanded to love our neighbor because our neighbor is essentially lovable? In other words, is neighbor love primarily the right of the object of that commandment to claim from another, or is it primarily the duty of the subject of that commandment to extend to another? In the second interpretation, that is, neighbor love as being primarily a duty, there is no reason for us to love our neighbor other than the fact that God has commanded us to do so. Here we need only intend the source of the commandment, but not its end. In fact, if there's an end at all, other than obedience alone. But in the first interpretation, our neighbor is essentially lovable. That is why our neighbor is to be loved. But why is the neighbor essentially lovable? Two answers can be given. The first answer is that the neighbor is lovable insofar as he or she is a human being created in the image of God. In other words, the neighbor is essentially lovable in as much as our being the image of God is the essence of our humanity. It is what makes us unique among all of God's creatures. That fact by itself commands, as it were, our deepest recognition, which is love. We love those who claim us by their very persona, that is, by their very self-presentation to us. And since every human being is to be the object of this commanded duty, that duty is the justified response to the exercise of a natural right that is exercised by the very presence of one human person to another. The one who's emphasized that, I think, most in modern Jewish thought is the late French Jewish philosopher Immanuel Levinas. Our neighbors are lovable then because God surely loves those whom God has made in his own image. They are surely the objects of God's loving concern. So how can we not love what God loves? Loving our neighbor, then, is imitating God. It's imitatio Dei. When we are aware of this value-laden fact, how could we not love them? For we now have good reason to love them. That is what creates the essential lovableness of our neighbors. It is the best, most sufficient reason why we are obligated to love them. Now, neighbor love is a natural right of its human object, the beloved, and it is a natural duty of its human subject, the lover. But inasmuch as the right to receive neighbor love cannot be enforced by human authorities, nor can one's refusal of the duty to give a neighbor love be penalized by human authorities, that right is a moral right as distinct from being a legal right. This approach is more conducive to the equation of neighbor love with the famous maxim of Hillel the Elder, "What is hateful to you, do not do to your fellow." This seems to be the negative version of the positive commandment to love one's neighbor. It's very interesting that the great modern Jewish thinker Achat Ha'am contrasted that Christianity talked about do unto others positively as you would have others do unto you, and Judaism mentions what is negatively, what is hateful to you, do not do to somebody else, and he made a big point about that. Unfortunately, he was wrong in historical grounds, because Maimonides presents the positive version of neighbor love, and in the Didache, which is the oldest Christian document after the New Testament, the negative version is found. So therefore, with all due respect to Achat Ha'am, this is not a distinction between Judaism and Christianity. There are others, but that's not one of them. You've got to locate where they are and where they're not. The second answer is that our Jewish neighbor, the Jewish neighbor, not just our specifically, a member of the covenant, is essentially lovable insofar as he or she is a fellow member of the people elected by God for a covenantal relationship. That election could only be an act of love. As such, a Jew's fellow Jewish neighbors are lovable because they are like him or her, having been chosen by God to be part of God's covenanted people. This divine election is the essence of being Jewish. It is what makes a Jew indelibly. This comes out in the syntax of the divine neighbor love commandment. You shall love your neighbor as yourself, ani Adonai, for I am the Lord. The Lord, the tetragrammaton, the four-lettered Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei name, is the name of God used especially when discussing God's election of Israel. So since for Judaism, Israel is the Jewish people, in this view, neighbor love is the Torah right of its Jewish object, and it is the Torah duty of its Jewish subject. Now, notwithstanding their differences in both interpretations, the source of the commandment is God's will. In both interpretations of God's willing, what is to be done has a discernible reason. And in both interpretations, whether it's my neighbor as a human being or my neighbor as a Jew, There is no role for a human court to either enforce compliance with or punish violations of the exercise of that right. That is so because whether one takes the commandment of neighbor love to be based on a natural right or to be based on a Torah right, in either interpretation of this right, it is a moral right, not a legal right. Only the Torah right of the poor of the covenanted community to receive definite, tangible, material welfare benefits, charity or tzedakah in Hebrew. And there's a distinction in rabbinic teaching between charity that's given where material aid as opposed to direct one-on-one personal contact that's called gemilut chasadim. Charity is considered a legal right as such that legal right can be enforced by human authorities, and human authorities can penalize non-response to this justifiable claim as dereliction of one's duty. And this indeed is discussed at length in the Talmud. And this approach is more conducive to the view that the maxim of Hillel, the elder, what is hateful to you, do not do to your fellow, is a minimal universal norm, and that this maxim is hardly unique to Judaism. Conversely, the commandment of neighbor love is a maximal norm and can only be given to the Jewish people who have experienced the particular kind of divine love they are now supposed to extend to each other. Furthermore, contrary to what has sometimes been charged, the positive right to be loved, even if that only attends Jews, though greater than the negative right not to be mistreated, does not imply mistreatment of those outside the range of covenantal love. Now, it could be said, however, that the normative Jewish tradition has compromised between the two interpretations of the commandment of neighbor love. For most often, it emphasizes that neighbor love is a Torah right. It is something uniquely commanded to Jews, and therefore something only a Jew can claim from another Jew. Nevertheless, it also teaches that any non-Jew, who could be any human being, could exercise that Torah right when that person is living within enough proximity to Jews to be able to be the objects of Jews to provide neighbor love to whomever they encounter. So that therefore one is obligated to attend to the needs, the personal needs of the Gentiles living among Jews as some sort of geri toshav or resident aliens. In other words, anybody could benefit from the beneficent Jews are commanded to provide to everybody living in their midst, however temporarily or accidentally. As such, any non-Jew fortunate enough to be so located could enjoy being the object of a Torah duty that can be seen, at least de facto, as his or her exercise of a natural universal right, having a particular subject but a universal object. And that is why in rabbinic thought, any non-Jew publicly accepts what is considered to be basic moral law, called a ger toshav, a resident sojourner, can be made into enough of a citizen of a Jewish polity to be able to enjoy the same civil rights and be obligated by the same duties as a full-fledged Jewish citizen of that polity. Moreover, these non-Jewish citizens are not required to convert to Judaism, thus implying that they are able to retain a good deal of their right of religious liberty. That point was especially made by the great German Jewish philosopher Hermann Cohn. Now, the only real difference between Jews and Gentiles regarding the right and duty of neighbor love is that Jews are commanded to seek out their fellow Jews to be benefited, which is not the case with Gentiles. Nevertheless, isn't that approach more consistent with the rights-based politics most modern people have come to accept and appreciate? After all, when one considers the fact that during most of history, when the members of one people reach out to actively benefit members of another people, there is often an agenda of political conquest or religious conquest behind that outreach, especially active proselytizing. However, doesn't the former type of conquest, that is political conquest, usually trample upon the right of others to their own political liberty? And doesn't the latter type of conquest, overt religious proselytizing, usually trample upon the rights of others to their own religious liberty? And haven't these two types of conquest often together as two parts of one, have been two parts of one imperialist agenda? So even though Jews may have lacked the political power to be able to openly and aggressively proselytize Gentiles, and even though there is no explicit prohibition in the Jewish tradition from Jews doing so, nevertheless, the long and painful experience of Jews being the victims of various imperialist agendas with their violations of their rights to political and religious liberty have made most Jews wary of doing to others what they never wanted done to themselves.